Good afternoon, everyone. Hello, good afternoon. Welcome to the Alaska World Affairs Council. My name is Lisa Falsko. I'm the Executive Director, and it's a pleasure to see everyone today. If you could please take a moment to turn off your cell phones. This program will be recorded for radio on KSKA, so if you could turn those off, we would appreciate it. Also, at the end of our program, if you could remember to wait for the microphone to come around for the question period, we do want to capture all of your questions for the Q&A on the radio as well. We are a membership organization. If you are not a member, now is a time when you should think of joining, because your membership will be good for the remaining part of this year as well as all of our next program year. And we're already starting to schedule some exciting speakers for the upcoming year, including the ambassador from the UK in June. At this time, I would like to recognize any students we have present. If you are a student, if you wouldn't mind standing for a few seconds and be recognized. Thank you very much. I see several students from Pacific Northern Academy. Pleasure to have you, and thank you so much to BP for sponsoring the student lunches and making it possible. Thank you very much. I'd also like to thank William for doing the recording today for KSKA. Thank you, William. At our head table today, to my very far left, is Michael Cook, who is a member of our board of directors, who you often might see in the corner recording for KSKA. Thank you for your help. And to his right is Keith Steinbaugh, the president of our board of directors, and he will be coming to the podium to introduce our speaker today. Keith.
Thanks, Lisa. Welcome, everybody. I'm glad to see you here today. It's my pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Dr. Stephen Cohen. Dr. Cohen joined the Brookings Institution in 1998 after a career as a professor of political science and history at the University of Illinois. He's also taught in India, in Japan, and in Singapore, and he served on the policy staff of the State Department. In 2004, he was named by the World Affairs Councils of America as one of America's 500 most influential people in the area of foreign policy. Dr. Cohen is the author, co-author, or editor of over 14 books, mostly on South Asian security issues. His most recent book is The Arming Without Aiming, India Modernizes Its Military. Other recent books include Four Crises and a Peace Process, American Engagement in South Asia, The Idea of Pakistan. And Dr. Cohen's current project attempts to characterize Pakistan's futures as of 2017. He spent 2 weeks in Pakistan this past September, and a preliminary report is on the Brookings website as the Bellagio Pakistan Papers. He's here today to speak to us on a very timely topic. Will Pakistan become the most dangerous country in the world? Please join me in welcoming Dr. Stephen Cohen to our podium.
Thank you, Keith. And on behalf of my wife, who's in here with us today, I'd like to express my gratitude to the World Affairs Council, not only for this meeting, but for arranging the meeting in Juneau, where Jim Clark was our host, and especially to Lisa, who bore with us because I was uncertain whether I could make it because of health reasons. But it's turned out to be more exciting and more adventurous than we thought. And I'd like to put my name in the queue for re-invitation. I'll talk about something else, but it's just a great place to visit. And I gather it's a nice place to live also, if you don't mind the change of seasons. But I really want to thank the council for inviting us and making this such a splendid visit. In a sense, the topic might be not will Pakistan become the most dangerous country in the world, but Pakistan between hope and despair. And there's a section in my own report which has that title. And again, I have to quote my former boss, George Shultz, who once told me, he said, we're offering some suggestions, you know, we hope that the Soviets do this, we hope that Chinese do that, blah, and so forth. He said to me and to others in the policy planning staff, he said, hope is not a policy. Get me a policy. Okay, so we went back and crossed out the word hope. and said policy. But then I was in Pakistan, this last trip in Pakistan, and I recounted that to a Pakistani ambassador, distinguished retired ambassador. And he said to me, he said, Stephen, despair is not a policy either. So I thought that also deserved a place above my desk. So one section in this, in the forthcoming book on the future of Pakistan, is entitled Between Hope and Despair. So somewhere in that spectrum, Pakistan lies. We're not quite sure where. What I'll do today is give you a quick briefing based on a project that I've been working on for the last year, 2 years in fact, on the future of Pakistan. And what I tried to do was to gather together a group of experts, people I thought knew Pakistan well, and sit and talk about this both in environments of Bellagio, which is a lovely, lovely place. I'm sure some of you have been there, but also, you know, in my own work and so forth. So let me go through the slides. First of all, let's begin with a quick map of Pakistan. We'll come back to it later. It's good to know the geography and location of a country. I've got a grandson who drew a map of India. He's only 8 years old, a fantastic map of India. He got most of it right, better than most of my graduate students did at Illinois. So here's your instant map of Pakistan. And I think what's interesting, that this country of 175 million people, one of the world's fifth or sixth largest country, which may be the world's fourth largest country, is surrounded by India to its east, Afghanistan, a struggling entity, to its west, and China to the north, as well as Russia to the north. So its geography puts it in a position where its territory is important in its own right. Pakistanis like to boast that they're a strategic location. But one of the things I'm collecting is statements by ambassadors and others who say, my country, fill in the blank X, is in a strategic location. Everybody says this. America is in a strategic location. So I think this is a term of art that diplomats use to magnify the importance of their country. But Pakistan clearly is surrounded by a very hostile country, India, in the Pakistani perspective, by a very weak country, Afghanistan, and to the north, a distant friend, China. But the United States is, in fact, a neighbor of Pakistan psychologically and economically and militarily. So let's go through the slides and that come out of the report. This presentation grows out of the Future of Pakistan project, which will be a book published by Brookings in the very near future. We met in May 2010 in Bellagio. There were 14 papers there. They're all on the Brookings website. I wrote a much longer paper myself, and that will eventually become a book. Of the experts I invited, seven were Pakistanis, a diplomat, a former military person, and others, a couple of academics. And the Indian was a scholar who knew China very well, and six or seven Americans and two Europeans. So I tried to get a mix of people to look at Pakistan. I wrote a monograph which sort of sums up the event, and then we did a public event at the U.S. Institute of Peace, which helped support this project. A lot of this is on the Brookings website where it's easily accessible. The methodology was not quite a Delphi panel. The term Delphi panel was introduced by the RAND Corporation in the 1960s, and their theory was that they would get a group of wise people together, and the wise people would predict the future. And RAND burned up a lot of American Defense Department money doing this. At Bellagio, I discovered from the British, one of the British participants, Sir Hilary Sinnott, he pointed out to me that the Oracle of Delphi was a woman and that her predictions, when listened to and followed, often were catastrophic. Because they're always misunderstood by the people who heard her make these predictions. So I scrubbed the term Delphi panel. That's why it's not quite a Delphi panel. And the participants were asked to look ahead, all 14 papers, look ahead 5 to 7 years and tell me what the variables were that they thought were important. Was it the economy? Was it culture? Was it the role of the military? What would shape Pakistan? And I had to get them condense this in 10 or 15 pages, and these are some of the shorter papers published. Pakistan is central, and that's why this project began. It's a nuclear weapon state. that has a very bad record of nuclear proliferation. Dr. A.Q. Khan is infamous for running the Walmart of nuclear proliferation, selling nuclear technology to the Iranians, to the Iraqis, to the perhaps to the Saudis, certainly to the Libyans and countries which are not yet identified. Others may know who they are, but that's out of my sphere of knowledge. So they spread nuclear technology around the world very quickly. They actively support jihadists and militants on terrorist attacks directed against India primarily, but indirectly they supported terrorist groups that operated in the UK and the United States. The Times Square bombing of about a year and a half ago was by an American citizen of Pakistani origin who was trained in Pakistan, not by the government, we think, we hope, but by militant groups in Pakistan who wanted to attack the United States. There's a dispute with India, which is based on identity. Kashmir is the central feature of it, but it's more than simply Kashmir. And they've had three or four wars recently in the past 10, 15 years, and they could have another one. And of course, both are nuclear weapon states. Pakistan's economy is stagnating. It's flat as a chapati. It's not going anywhere. So this government's trying to revive it. But I think Pakistan missed the boat of globalization, where they could take advantage of new global economic trends. Its economy was hit badly by the earthquake of a couple of years ago. The demography of Pakistan looks very bad. Enormous birth rate, huge birth rate, and of course the education and the economy have not kept up with that huge birth rate. And Pakistan could be a major disruptive factor in South Asia vis-a-vis India. They play a major role in Afghanistan now, where they both support the Taliban and they also support the Americans in fighting the Taliban. You know, they're playing both sides against the middle. So it's all for all these reasons. You know, I've never liked the term AFPAC, and I've always thought it should be PAC-F. In other words, Pakistan before Afghanistan. And I think that some officials in the U.S. government agree with this characterization, that we've placed too much emphasis on Afghanistan, which is going to be a temporary phenomenon, but Pakistan should require more emphasis. I'm pleased that Vice President Biden, when he was Senator Biden, sponsored legislation, which became the Kerry-Lugar Berman bill, which provided massive economic assistance to Pakistan over the long term to address these domestic problems facing Pakistan. I think for the first time in history, we saw Pakistan as a long-term problem, not simply a temporary ally. The project had came up with 19 variables. I won't go through them in detail, but there were four clusters. The first cluster were domestic issues, that is, what's happening within Pakistan with its economy and society. The second cluster looked at the collective identity of the Pakistani people. You know, how did the Pakistanis feel as Pakistanis? What was their solidarity as Pakistanis, as opposed to being Baluch or Sindhis or Punjabis, the different ethnic groups that comprise Pakistan? The third cluster pertained to the stateness of Pakistan, the ability of the Pakistan state to get things done. How good was the government itself in meeting and reaching targets that it set regarding the country? And the fourth cluster, of course, is Pakistan's environment. How did the Pakistanis affect, what was their relationship with their major neighbors, India and China, with Afghanistan, and above all, with the United States? Because I think we're a major factor in Pakistani politics and Pakistani identity. When I wrote my Idea of Pakistan book, I interviewed a bunch of American ambassadors who had served in Pakistan, and all of them said the same thing, that they were treated as if they were part of the Pakistani cabinet. And most of them said, we did not want this role. We did not want to be part of Pakistani politics. But the military, the civil Pakistani politicians would come to the ambassadors, the American ambassador, and say, Ambassador so-and-so, would you support us against this other group? And then the other group would come to the ambassador and say, we want American support against this group. So we became willy-nilly part of Pakistani domestic politics, which I thought was a very unhealthy thing for us to do. Of course, the Pakistanis themselves wanted us involved in their politics and now criticize us for being involved in their politics. It's a relationship between two countries, which is an unhealthy relationship. Now let's look at some of the variables, but I'll go through these quickly. First cluster, demography, education and youth, the middle class myth, and the economy. Let me talk about the middle class myth because I take a contrarian view about that. There's widespread belief in Washington, at least, that the middle classes represent hope for the Islamic world, so-called Islamic world, now, that democracy and progress rest on our middle classes. While to some degree that's true, and I think we see that in Egypt, historically, if you go back in time, 50, 60, 100 years, middle classes have also been the nurturing grounds for totalitarianism and radical movements. I mean, Mao, Lenin, Stalin, they were all middle class individuals. I think Mao was a librarian. Stalin was a priest in training. So the fact that there's a middle class does not necessarily mean democracy. Middle classes sometimes turn to autocracy, even totalitarianism. The economy is clear. I mean, Pakistan's economy has been stagnant. They're lucky to get 2% growth, which does not keep up with population. They're looking at 5%. They're hoping for 5%. But again, where Pakistan is situated, they simply don't make anything in Pakistan that is valuable to other countries. The only thing they produce in quantity and quality are terrorists and drugs and narcotics. So that's not exactly the way in which you fit into the world's modern economy. Second cluster. I skipped one, pardon me. The identity of Pakistan. Pakistanis are really still divided among themselves about what it means to be a Pakistani. One definition of being a Pakistani is that we're not Indians. But having a negative identity doesn't get you very far in the modern world. And what's a positive goal of being a Pakistani? Pakistanis, you know, the leaders of Pakistan like to claim that they're the most moderate of all the Islamic states, but in fact, Pakistan has become more radicalized. So that's an identity which is still under dispute. And of course, the Islamist parties in Pakistan would like to see Pakistan as an Islamist country, not as a secular country. So there's a big debate among Pakistanis within Pakistan about what it means to be Pakistani. And of course, there are groups in Pakistan, in the Sindh and in Balochistan in the Northwest Frontier Province, which has been renamed, would like to leave Pakistan. They don't want to be Pakistanis. So there's a inconsistency in Pakistanis' identity of themselves. And I think that's very important in terms of shaping a modern nation state. The coherence of the Pakistani state, it's been primarily a state run by and dominated by the military of Pakistan. And as I told General Kiani, and I've written many times, you know, the army cannot run Pakistan, but it won't let others run Pakistan either. The army cannot find Pakistani politicians that it regards as worthy of themselves. In a sense, the army is too powerful in the state apparatus of Pakistan. It dominates Pakistan state. And there's a Chinese metaphor. Pakistan has one leg like an elephant and another leg like a chopstick. And it can't run very fast with its big, powerful army leg and this weak civilian chopstick leg. So again, there's imbalance in the government of Pakistan, the governance of Pakistan. I won't go into the details of some of the other points, but you get my general argument. External and global factors. The case of Afghanistan, the Pakistanis have a legitimate interest in a positive outcome in Afghanistan. Of all of Afghanistan's neighbors, including Iran, the Pakistanis have the most at stake in that there's a huge overlap between the Pakistani Pashtuns and the Afghan Pashtuns. It's a huge tribal belt that was divided in half by the British. So Pakistan has a legitimate concern about the fate of Afghanistan. To implement that interest, to exercise that concern, what they do is they're supporting the Taliban. And they regard the Taliban as their players in the Afghan political setup. So they're going to continue to support the Taliban until they see a government in Kabul emerge, which matches up with Pakistan's basic interest. Again, of course, here's a dispute with the United States. We opposed the Taliban, although at one point we did support them also. And we're trying to kill the Taliban leadership, whereas the Pakistanis are supporting them and giving them safe harbor in Pakistan itself. So their policy of supporting the Taliban as a Pashtun group in Afghanistan leads them into direct conflict with the United States. So I won't say that covers the American part of this. China is regarded by Pakistan as a permanent friend. The Chinese have a less enthusiastic view about the relationship, but Pakistan is important to China because the Chinese use Pakistan to balance India. So there's a three-way balance of power between Pakistan, India, and China, all nuclear weapon states now. But the Chinese also use Pakistan as an entry point into the Middle East. Pakistan was the country that allowed the Chinese access into its own territory, and then from Pakistan into the Middle East. And when we get to the map, I can show you how that worked. I won't say much about globalization and nuclear weapons, except that Pakistan is doing very, very well in terms of developing nuclear weapons. They're probably the world's biggest producer of nuclear weapons now. They're over 100 as far as we can tell, far larger than anybody had expected. And the Pakistani view of these things is more is enough. It's like Samuel Gompers in labor negotiations. How much do you want, Mr. Gompers? More. What do you want? More. So from the Pakistani point of view, more nuclear weapons are enough. Because they believe that they're racing India. And of course, the Indians are racing China. So it's a three-way nuclear arms race in South Asia. And it's leaking over into the Middle East. One thing that's certain is that if Iran goes nuclear, there will be Pakistani role in the Middle East as a nuclear weapon state. So you're going to have a linkage between the South Asian nuclear arms balance between India and Pakistan, and possibly a Middle East nuclear arms balance between Iran, Israel, and perhaps Saudi Arabia. As for globalization, I'll just say one sentence. Pakistan missed the boat on globalization in every possible way. Okay, looking ahead, what did the project conclude? Now, I have to say that all of the participants had their own version of the conclusions. I can't speak for them, but I can speak for my view as project director of what I thought we all came out. We think that there'll be another 5 years of Pakistan as it is now. We did not predict a radical transformation of Pakistan soon. But all of these deeper variables, the environment, environmental degradation, the economy, education, they're all negative or stagnant. So after 5 years, you become very concerned about the integrity of Pakistan. A second optional future for Pakistan, and I think it's already in there now, what I call parallel Pakistans. That is, every part of Pakistan will be called Pakistan, but some parts will actually have very little relationship with Islamabad. They'll do their own deals with countries across the border. And those of you who know the Middle East know that this is what's happened to Lebanon. The Lebanese have agreements with the Israelis. Other Lebanese have agreements with the Iranians. Others have agreements with some of the Syrians. Lebanon is a country where different factions of Lebanon have different working arrangements with outside countries. So this is beginning to happen in Pakistan. I won't go into the details, but Pakistan is beginning to lose control over some of its parts. And the military, of course, are pressed with a huge rebellion in Balochistan, one of the provinces, as well as an act of war in the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province. So the military are overstretched themselves in terms of repressing or controlling separatist movements. So I think the future is likely to be more of the same, but also the drifting away of parts of Pakistan. Much less likely, I'd give it a probability of 10%, would be all of the following. So I think none of these are likely, and maybe they all have a small probability of happening under 10% or under. So let me read them. Democratic consolidation, the emergence of a truly democratic Pakistan, a breakaway and breakup of Pakistan, really formal disintegration of the state, civil or military authoritarianism, where some man on a white horse shows up and says, I'm going to run this country properly, I'm going to make sure everybody is obedient and uses force to enforce compliance. That would work in Pakistan, I think, for about 6 months, and I think after that it would break down. Pakistanis are not amenable to authoritarianism. And finally, an army-led revolution. Number six would be an army-led revolution. You could imagine a Pakistan army, or at least you conceive of the Pakistan army doing what Ataturk did in Turkey, where the Turkish army reconstructed the whole state. They turned it into a secular, modern state as best they could, and they enforced it. I don't see that happening in the Pakistan army. reasons I can go into in the Q&A. They understand that the present situation in Pakistan is not workable, but they don't have the vision, I think, to have a revolution, lead a revolution in Pakistan, primarily because of their foreign policy problem with India. I think that holds them back from imposing dramatic reforms on Pakistan. And finally, what I call post-crisis scenarios. You could imagine a Pakistan after a war with India, a major crisis with India, or a major crisis with the United States, for that matter, over Afghanistan. And these are sort of unimaginable futures. I mean, you can just speculate all day and all night about what would happen to Pakistan after a major war with India, especially if that war went nuclear. It's not a pleasant thought, but it could happen. But again, I give that a low probability, but it's within the realm of the possible, so therefore I've included it. Okay, towards a normal Pakistan, what things have to be done to have a normal Pakistan, one that's at peace with itself and with its neighbors? I think there's 6 or 7 necessary things to happen. I think I put at the top normalized relations with India. And when this project began, I was very pessimistic about India-Pakistan relations. But since about 2 months ago, in a sense, has been sort of another breakthrough with normalization with India. A cricket match which led to a visit of the Pakistani Prime Minister to India, and in a sense, the normalization, the peace process is back on track. It's very parallel to what's happening in the Middle East, where the Arabs and the Israelis fight each other, then they go to peace with each other and so forth. The difference is that there's no American intervention in South Asia. It's primarily regional initiatives. So normalized relations with India, I think, are a necessary but not sufficient condition for a normal Pakistan. A revived economy is also necessary. They're doing the best they can do, I think, but whether that's enough is an open question. I'm very skeptical about a rapid growing Pakistan economy. Repair the Pakistani state. Again, everybody knows what has to be fixed. Whether you can fix it is another question when a lot of your good people are leaving the country and emigrating abroad. A rebalanced civil-military relationship, get the military's leg down to normal size, increase the size of the civilian leg, so it's not an elephant's leg and a chopstick, it's two normal legs, and Pakistan runs on two normal legs. Fighting the domestic insurgents, they do present a major threat to Pakistan, and the army has come to the realization they've got to use some of their firepower against their own civilians, against Pakistanis who are trying to destroy the Pakistani state or take it over. And finding a new role for Pakistan vis-a-vis its neighbors, and also allowing a reshaped police force to emerge. All of these recommendations will appear in a report that's forthcoming from the Asia Society. The new version of that report, which I just signed off on, has a much longer list, but a similar list of about 15 different things that have to happen for Pakistan to become normal. Now just ask yourself the question, how likely will all these things happen? And the answer is not terribly likely. They may do well in a few categories, or they may do moderately well in some, but that all of these things are going to come out shining and rosy is unlikely. That's, I think, the big question over the future of Pakistan. This leads to warning signs, and again, they're the mirror image of the things that have to be done. I'll just go through them quickly. Unwillingness to deal quickly with economic issues. I think they are actually moving properly in this direction. Unwillingness to, or inability to, rebuild the state institutions. They're beginning to do this slowly, but it's difficult to accomplish when you have entrenched bureaucracies. Absence of governance at the top. This raises the question of the quality of the leadership at the very top of Pakistan, leaving aside the military, who I think are pretty good, President Zardari, Benazir Bhutto's widow, and the Prime Minister, Jilani. And they're not the kind of people you would pick as movers and shakers, but they've managed to get through crisis after crisis. In fact, I gave a talk in Washington about a year ago, And Ambassador Haqqani was there. In fact, you should invite him here. He'd love it, and he'd give a great talk. He'd persuade you that Pakistan is going to succeed no matter what. Marvelous person, really good friend of mine. I stood up and I said to an audience like this, I said, Pakistan has the best civilian government it's ever had in its history. And Haqqani beamed at me, smiled at me. And then I had to explain to the audience that that may not be a very good government because all the other civilian governments were terrible. In fact, most of them were overthrown by military dictators for good reason, not accident, but for good reason. And furthermore, Pakistan is faced with problems that earlier civilian governments never had. So even if it's the best civilian government they've ever had, is it capable of taking on this long list of problems? I don't know. I'm somewhere between hope and despair, to be honest, my own view. So you get on the list, unwillingness to rebuild state institutions, absence of government at the top, the begging bowl syndrome. Pakistanis have become used to begging the Americans and the IMF for loans, for money, and since they've got to achieve some more independence and self-respect and get over that. And another fresh crisis with India that could wreck the whole thing very quickly, and further appeasement of the Islamists. By and large, the Pakistanis play footsie with the Islamists. The military use them sometimes for purposes of attacking liberals in Pakistan or attacking India or other countries. So the Islamists are used by the state against other states or at home, which is a very dangerous game. And now the military understands that these people have come back to haunt them. But the politicians also play footsie with the Islamists. Most Pakistani politicians have deals, arrangements with Islamic parties, or radical Islamic parties, because they're afraid of them. So in a sense, this is something that Pakistanis have to work at themselves. What role will Islamist leaders play in politics? Some will play a good, sensible role. Some of them are actually just politicians who wear the Islamic cloak for political purposes. Some are actually bent on transforming Pakistan and turning into a Sharia-driven state, an Islamist state, which won't work in Pakistan. So this is another question about the future of Pakistan. Policy. At Brookings, we have to have policy. Okay. Sometimes we do the analysis first and then we have policy. Sometimes we have the policy first and then we do the analysis to support the policy. No, Brookings never does that. We don't do that. But I do know some think tanks that have views on the world, and their scholars are ordered to sort of come up with reasons why these views should be supported. The great thing about working at Brookings and a few other Washington think tanks is that as scholars we're left completely alone in terms of what we do and how we do it. So for better or for worse, there's no Brookings line on a lot of issues. Current policy, I think, is okay. Not great, but okay. It's derived primarily from our American engagement in NATO and NATO's engagement in Afghanistan, and we see Pakistan as a player in Afghanistan. But Biden and others have clearly looked beyond that, and they see Pakistan as an important country in its own right. I'm not sure about the president's view on this, but I know Vice President Biden has always held this view. So while we're driven by our Afghan policy and therefore dependent on Pakistan for access to Afghanistan and supplies to Afghanistan, there's also consideration in the second paragraph about strengthening Pakistan itself. I think the Japanese understand this, most Western powers understand this, that you can't allow Pakistan to drift regardless of what happens in Afghanistan. So I think we're beginning in Washington and elsewhere to separate Afghanistan and Pakistan as two separate although linked problems. Now, what are the alternatives to the present policy of sort of helping Pakistan over this hump and trying to normalize relations with Pakistan? There are several radically different policies. One would be to dump Pakistan and support India in South Asia. I think that would be a mistake because even the Indians understand that a failed Pakistan would threaten India as much as anything else. So the Indians aren't that keen about being our close ally against Pakistan. They don't like Pakistan. Many Indians would like to see Pakistan disappear, but they don't want to see it disappear in a mushroom cloud. You know, as I've told many Indian friends, we spent a month there, you know, if your neighbor's house is on fire, you don't take joy in that. And that's because the sparks are going to blow over into your house. So the Indians are now concerned, especially Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, about the stability of Pakistan. So if we abandon Pakistan and put all of our marbles on the Indian side, that's not going to solve anything. We could move to a policy, and we may move to a policy in a couple of years from now, if things turn very badly, of treating Pakistan as a threat, a rogue state, a nuclear-armed, dangerous state. I don't think that's going to happen, but you can imagine some countries and some policymakers thinking Pakistan is the enemy. So let's ally with other countries against Pakistan. The Pakistanis believe this is going to happen. They're very concerned that our alliance with India is aimed against them, which is not true. So instead of balancing Pakistan with India, we could try to contain Pakistan. That may be necessary if Pakistan turns for the worst, but I wouldn't predict that at this point. We could withdraw completely from Afghanistan and Pakistan, just cut our losses and get out. Have sort of what's technically it's termed offshore balancing. We try to balance the region from outside the region. Again, without being there and without having a role in the countries, military and economic and so forth, our influence will be very minor. And that would, in a sense, leave Pakistan to China. The Chinese have a strong relationship with Pakistan that would confirm that the Chinese are a dominant South Asian power vis-a-vis Pakistan. And, of course, the Indians would be afraid to face China and Pakistan face up against China and Pakistan. So that's an option which I think is not very attractive, but to me at least. Finally, we can, and this is not doesn't depend on the future, but we could now try to work to facilitate India-Pakistan normalization. The difficulty with that is that while the Pakistanis want us in the region to put pressure on India, the Indians are reluctant to have the Americans engaged in a regional peace process. They look at the Middle East and they say, we don't need the Americans in South Asia. So they would deeply resist any American attempt to be a balancer or facilitator between India and Pakistan, or peacemaker. What we can do, and I think our policy states, in fact, we would facilitate. If the Indians and the Pakistanis came to us and said, we'd like your help in normalizing our relationship, there may be ways in which the United States could help. We could offer assistance in environmental issues, water resources, guarding their nuclear weapons. There are a lot of little things we could be doing with both countries, perhaps separately, that would make it easier for them to normalize the relationship. And I think that's probably what our role should be in the near future. Okay, some summary statements. Pakistan could be the most dangerous state in the world, but again, I'm somewhere between hope and despair. I refuse to come down on the yes or no side of it. I retain my academic ambivalence, and what is the joke about economists? Harry Truman said, "Get me some left-handed economists, because all the economists say on the one hand, on the other hand." Well, this is a case where, on the one hand, Pakistan could be a dangerous state, but on the other hand, maybe it won't be. So, but my four aphorisms are, nations are ideas, and states are bureaucracies, and Pakistan struggles with both. That is, the idea of Pakistan is in trouble, and the state of Pakistan is in trouble, so Pakistan is struggling, and they know it, in a sense, Pakistanis are aware of this now. Secondly, Pakistan is a paranoid state, frightened of the world, but it has real enemies. This is a paranoid state with real enemies. So part of the paranoia is understandable. Thirdly, the military can't govern Pakistan, but won't let the civilians govern either. This is what I told General Kiani. He nodded his agreement, but what he's going to do, I do not know. Very taciturn, but effective. Finally, a point that comes out of this project, America is badly organized to deal with South Asia as a whole. If you look in Bruce Rydell, my colleague at Brookings, and I just written an op-ed piece, and we're arguing for a new South Asia command in the Pentagon, that we've divided India and Pakistan into different military commands, and in the State Department and the National Security Council also, we divided the two countries. And we argue that South Asia will be important for the United States for the indefinite future. India is a major rising economic power, no doubt about it. Not quite China, but it's on the same China track. Pakistan is a declining, enfeebled, but still nuclear weapon state, which deserves our full attention. We can't sort of parcel these off to different bureaucracies who have to deal with them. It's an integrated whole, because from an Indian perspective, Pakistan is the major security threat. From a Pakistani perspective, India is the major security threat. So by dividing our policy making in different bureaucracies. I think we're not pursuing this efficiently. That's about, let me just conclude by, show you the map again. This map again shows, I think clearly, Pakistan's centrality vis-a-vis India, China in the upper right, and Afghanistan. As long as that's the case, and it's going to be the case indefinitely, Pakistan is going to be important to the United States for better and for worse. Let me stop there and thank you for your attention, and I hope to respond to questions and comments. Thank you.
I want to thank you for that excellent briefing. Actually, a couple of questions come to mind, but I'll stick to one. You mentioned that in terms of Afghanistan, Pakistanis saw sort of the Taliban as the group that sort of most represents their interests presently, although they would be willing to throw over the Taliban if they saw a government in Kabul that actually did, they perceived, represent their interests. What would such a government look like?
If you had the answer to that and came to Washington, we'd make you the central figure in the debate. One of the astonishing things is that nobody knows. I mean, the Taliban, I'm not an Afghan expert. Let me confess that. And I was on the Chris Matthews show once, right after 9/11. He asked me something about the Taliban in Afghanistan. And I said, Chris, I just don't know about much about it. I've never been there. He muttered, he said, honest man. So I took that as a compliment, but then he didn't invite me back because I was not able to bullshit my way through that answer. But I got a lot of friends in Washington, and a lot of them are really good Afghan experts. They've lived there, they work there, and they're not sure themselves what the Taliban are, who the Taliban are. I know in Vietnam when we fought the North Vietnamese and the South Vietnamese irregulars, we had tables of organization which were more or less accurate. In Afghanistan, we don't know who the Taliban are. We know they're different factions and groups, but it's sort of impermeable to us. Maybe some intelligence agency in the U.S. knows about this, but I certainly don't, and I don't think my American friends know this. So we're guessing when we talk about the Taliban, and therefore we're guessing when we talk about what a Kabul government will look like that included the Taliban. But Afghanistan is a state with many ethnic and ethnic and subnational minorities. In a sense, they all have to be included in it one way or the other. My own view is, again, as an Afghan amateur, not a specialist, so we made a huge mistake after the Bonn conference when we failed to adopt a regional approach to Afghanistan. In other words, have the Iranians, the Indians, the Pakistanis, the Russians, and the Chinese involved in a settlement. And I think they're moving back to that now. I think the Obama administration may return to that idea. There's a new report by the Century Commission, headed by Lakhdar Brahimi and Tom Pickering, who's probably the best diplomat of our generation, who argue for a return to a regional approach. But that requires cooperation among two sets of odd couples for it to work. The Americans have to work with the Iranians, at least a bit, and we have to hold our noses and deal with Tehran, because the Iranians have a shared interest with us in a stable Afghanistan. They don't want to see a radical Sunni government take over Afghanistan. And the Indians and the Pakistanis have to work together also. That's also seems to be an improbable kind of thing to happen. But I've been arguing in Washington that American policy should pursue not a Kashmir settlement. I think that's over the horizon. But India-Pakistan relationship in Afghanistan have rules of the game so the Indians can be there. They have the largest aid program of all in Afghanistan, and the Pakistanis can be there. And there's assurance between both of them that they're not trying to encircle, outflank the other. So I think we need to be able to verify that. So I'm hopeful that the administration will move in that direction. But again, hope is not a policy. So.
Hi. It seems as though all this area, this entire region, is broken up mainly by specific religious identifying groups. Is there some way that would help if some of these borders were changed?
The borders were mostly set by the imperial powers. Afghanistan was created by the British who drew lines so that the Russians would stay on the other side of whatever line. Afghanistan was created as a buffer state. And India-Pakistan division was purely artificial by the Brits who wanted to get out quickly, leaving Punjabis on both sides of that line. So theoretically, you're right that a redivision of borders was appropriate because the borders divide people. The Durand line divides Pashtuns in both Afghanistan and Pakistan. But you tell me how you start reorganizing international borders. I think these things are frozen in concrete right now. They just it would be a fool's errand to start this policy. You could argue that, and I've done some writing on this, that American policy should be to stabilize the existing borders, because the border between India and Pakistan is still disputed, because Kashmir is on both sides of that. The border between India and China is still disputed. There's a boundary dispute between India and China. That's the largest boundary dispute in the world. The Durand line between Pakistan and Afghanistan is still disputed. So in a sense, maybe an American policy or an initiative by America and others say, okay, we know there are disputed boundaries. Let's at least draw the lines permanently so there's no confusion over where they are. Now, you're dealing with countries that are all nuclear weapon states for the most part. So the risk of an escalation of war is the cost of an escalation would be very great. So I think your idea of looking at the borders, again, is correct, but not to erase them, but perhaps solidify them.
Thank you for coming. I'm sorry. Thank you for coming. And I wanted to ask you a question about the United States has had a very long relationship with Pakistan. And I can't understand how the United States was silent for so long with the proliferation and the Walmart, as you called it, of nuclear weapons by Mr. Khan or Dr. Khan.
I was part of that process. My sole claim to fame as a former government official, I was one of the people who looked the other way. I mean, I didn't, but I was part of an administration that did. We knew the Pakistanis were going nuclear. We had great intelligence from various sources as to exactly how they were going nuclear. In fact, at one point, I was told by my fellow American intelligence people, you can talk to this Pakistani and that Pakistani about their nuclear program, but not to those Pakistanis because they don't know about it. So, yes, in essence, I could talk to Zia about it because I knew everything about his nuclear program, and I did talk to him about it. But there were others who didn't know about it. It was a bizarre situation for me to be in, but it was actually kind of fun. It boiled down to this. The Pakistanis were lying to the world about our involvement in Afghanistan. We were in Afghanistan up to our noses, helping the Mujahideen, drive the Soviets out. We were deeply involved. It was the largest CIA operation in history, may still be the largest in history. So they were lying to the world about that, because all the weapons were going through Pakistan, across the border, to the same people we're now fighting. But they were on our side then, because they were freedom fighters. But they were expected us in turn to lie about their nuclear program. And I had a bizarre conversation with a Pakistani friend of mine, diplomat friend of mine, who said, why are you so upset about our nuclear program? We're lying about your presence in Afghanistan. Why don't you lie about our nuclear program? And it was a quid pro quo. There's a new book out by Ambassador Howard and Teresita Schaefer called How Pakistan Negotiates with the United States. Brilliant book. It's one of the five best books written about Pakistan, just published by the U.S. Institute of Peace. I wrote the foreword to it, and I recount that story. So we've always had this weird agreement with Pakistan, arrangement with Pakistan, where they lie to us, and we know they're lying to us, and we accept their lies. So when we call them on a lie, they get angry and upset. Why are you all of a sudden calling us on an issue which you knew we were doing? So that's the case of the Taliban and other issues also. So we're in the process of normalizing our relationship with Pakistan. We're rediscovering the history we had with Pakistan. In fact, last year you had Ambassador Dennis Cox here as a speaker, I gather. Is that right, Lisa? Or maybe he was in down in Juneau. Yeah. And Dennis has written a classic book on U.S.-Pakistan relationship. And we have a history, we have an understanding of Pakistan. They have a different understanding of us. So even at the very top, there's not much agreement among the leaders as to what this common history is. Every time Mike Mullen goes to Pakistan, he's been there 20 times already, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, he's told a history of Pakistan by the history of the relationship by the Pakistanis, which does not match up with the history of the relationship told by his staff. So we've not yet come to an honest understanding of what our history is, let alone what the future will be. Maybe that was more of an answer than you wanted, but
yeah. Okay, well, hi, thank you for coming. That was the answer in terms of the development of the nuclear program there. But what did we know about AQ Khan's, at least theoretically, rogue operation? I mean, your theory is that Pakistan may become the world's most dangerous country. I would think in some respects it already is and has been since they went free-ranging on, you know, selling nuclear material and plans.
As far as I know the history of that, and I don't think the whole truth has come out yet, we understood pretty clearly that AQ Khan was buying nuclear technology around the world. And this was Pakistani policy. Every Pakistani official with privilege and knowledge about the nuclear weapons program understood that Dr. Khan had a huge operation of sucking up nuclear technology or technology related to nuclear weapons from many countries, Switzerland, the United States, Canada, Europe, the whole business. So it was a shopping expedition. What came clear later, and it's still not quite clear who authorized it, if anybody, was that the same organization that was shopping and buying and sucking up equipment from around the world was also selling technology. And the North Korean case is a good example of this. The Pakistanis got from North Korea missile technology. They may have provided to North Korea nuclear technology. And the key question is not only what we knew, but what the Chinese knew. Because the Chinese were responsible originally for some of the nuclear technology given to Pakistan. Did the Chinese arrange the deal between their two closest friends, the North Koreans and the Pakistanis, where they would swap nuclear and missile technology? I do not know. That's as plausible a theory as any I can come up with. So I don't really know exactly what went on with the AQ Khan selling operation. He's become a popular hero in Pakistan. Demigod in Pakistan, because he defied the West and made Pakistan independent. Now, I actually think he was right, and I'm not a non-proliferation Ayatollah. I think that in this case, from a Pakistani point of view, I would have done the same thing, because they were worried about an overwhelming Indian military capability, like it's analogous to the Israelis. So by acquiring nuclear weapons, AQ Khan has said publicly many times, we prevented three wars with India. There were several occasions under which a dominant Indian military might have invaded Pakistan. So from their point of view, unless you're anti-nuclear weapons completely, which some Americans are, but most are not, it made sense for them to go nuclear, but to sell the weapons technology elsewhere was another thing completely. I think a reconciliation on the nuclear issue should come out, and I've been publicly in favor of giving Pakistan a similar nuclear deal to the deal we did with the Indians on the condition that they actually come clean as to what they did in sharing nuclear technology to these other countries.
I wonder if you could address the idea of the intense anti-Americanism in Pakistan and how that affects our dealing with them, and what can we do to counter that?
Did everybody hear the question? The intense anti-Americanism in Pakistan, yeah. And what can you do to counter it? On the public opinion polls taken in Pakistan, which are pretty good for the most part, America is number one on the hate list. India is number three, or number two or three. So we're disliked more than the Indians in Pakistan, which is quite an accomplishment. But what we're doing is, and I think this is recognized fully by this administration, the Bush people paid no attention to it. There's a massive attempt to reach out to Pakistani journalists. when I get back to Washington, I'm going to meet with about 25 Pakistani journalists who are making a tour of the United States just to see America for themselves. And there's a huge U.S. information operation in Pakistan now. Maybe too much, too late. And maybe that, you know, maybe it's overkill, but I think it's better to do it late than never. Because Pakistanis are deeply misinformed about the United States, and conspiracy theories range widely in Pakistan. I don't want to offend anybody, but if you looked at Pakistani television, you can imagine 50 Fox channels going on at the same time. You know, the channels until recently vied with each other to be anti-American, because that was a safe and cheap thing to do. And the government of Pakistan did not stand by the United States in cases where the government of Pakistan should have stood by us. For example, the drone attacks in Pakistan are partly done at the guidance of the Pakistan government. But the Pakistan government won't admit that. In a sense, they're sort of cowardly on that issue. They're afraid of this mass Fox News entity out there. And even General Kiani has said to me and others, he said publicly, said, you know, they have to watch out for public opinion in Pakistan. They're afraid of public opinion, which is a very tiny, tiny elite in Pakistan that watch English or Urdu television. So it's a public opinion issue. But beyond that, from a Pakistani point of view, I can understand their anger. Because for generations, we've supplied Pakistan with huge amounts of military equipment based on a quid pro quo vis-a-vis the Soviets or the Russians, and now the Taliban. But we neglected Pakistan's domestic, economic, and educational infrastructure. We didn't care about it. Even the Bush administration recently, in a sense, Musharraf was a dictator, but he was our dictator. No need to ask further questions. There was a huge contradiction that Pakistanis were aware of between the Bush II administration's emphasis on democracy in the Middle East and their total apathy towards democracy in Pakistan. And they resented that because they did not like, after a while, Musharraf became very unpopular. He was in power because of American support. So I think the turnaround has come. It began in the U.S. Senate with Kerry, Biden and Senator Lugar. The House signed on to it, where we have a huge program, I think $2.5 billion a year, of support for Pakistani education, for its economy, and also for democratization, supporting the political parties in Pakistan.
Well, I'm not sure I want to thank you for coming today. I felt pretty good earlier, and now I feel terrible. I was struck by two things earlier in your talk that you mentioned. First of all, that the population was growing like crazy, and then the second was that the economy was in the pits. It sounds like sort of Bangladesh, the basket case we used to talk about, and I'm wondering, given those dynamics, whether really the one unifying feature of Pakistan is that it is Islamic, and whether indeed some kind of an Ayatollah with a military flourish is in fact the most probable future for Pakistan?
I wouldn't compare it with Bangladesh because Bangladeshis have actually come out of the status of being a basket case. Their per capita income is higher than Pakistan. The government's more effective than that in Pakistan. It's quite astonishing. When I wrote the book on the idea of Pakistan, I had all the data about Bangladesh and then of Pakistan next to itself, and also Indonesia. And Pakistan comes out worse than Bangladesh, because they've neglected their own integrity for all these years. One thing that keeps Bangladesh afloat is the huge international involvement in Bangladesh, with all the UN and NGO participants in the Bangladesh society. So that makes it, and that keeps the military out of politics in Bangladesh. None of those things are true of Pakistan, where the military deeply involved and there's very little international NGO involvement. But the Bangladeshis don't challenge India. You know, they've accommodated themselves to a larger Indian neighbor, whereas the Pakistanis feel that they can still challenge India militarily. So I think, to me as a strategist, the root issue is this military strategic competition between India and Pakistan. And once you normalize that relationship, and I'm not optimistic that's going to happen, then I think there's an opportunity then for all these other things to flow. People-to-people exchanges, regional economic integration. You know, there's two theories. One is that states normalize themselves strategically and get along with afterwards. And the other theory is that people-to-people ties grow and economic ties grow, and the states are then forced to normalize relations. I think the first is probably more historically more accurate, that the Indian and the Pakistani leadership have to decide that we will have normal relations and all the kumbaya moments will flow from that. But again, I'm writing a book about that now, and I think as I write, so you have to wait for about a year or 2 years before I can actually give you a definitive answer on that. Invite me back and I'll tell you what it is.
How far did AQ Khan go in transferring nuclear technology to Gaddafi, and what brought it to an end?
He went very far. Fortunately, the Libyans didn't know what to do with it. But there was all kinds of hardware showed up in Libya, and the Libyans, and I'm not sure exactly what deal was done. I think we just threatened to bomb the hell out of Libya if they pursued their nuclear program. But but apparently the Libyans didn't have the scientists or engineers to take advantage of it or do it quickly, because they would have to do it quickly before the Israelis or the United States took it out. So Gaddafi underwent a sea change, confessed that he had nuclear technology. It all came, most of it came from Pakistan, and normalized the relationship. The irony is that we're all anti-Gaddafi now. He's seen as the most brutal, incompetent dictator in the world, functioning now. But he, at one point, he did the right thing. Perhaps under coercion and threat, but he did the right thing and abandoned his nuclear weapons program. I think he calculated that if he pursued it any further, the Israelis would have come in and taken it out, or we would have done that. And maybe that was the threat given to him.
Thank you for coming. And you mentioned that Pakistan has two economies. Two items in their economy right now, drugs and nuclear. What are the realistic possibilities do they have? What could they develop?
I think that realistically, they must be part of a South Asian economic zone. They must integrate with the Indian economy, because Indians are the dynamic, you know, a dynamic growth engine in that part of the world. But for political reasons, they can't do it. And I've briefed Indian software companies, for example, going to Pakistan, who asked me who should they see and who should they meet. So they go there, they meet and they talk, they come back, they said, we could do the deal technically, but we can't do it politically. That is, the Pakistan government won't allow it, won't allow cooperation with an Indian firm. So what we will do, they told me, is we're going to cooperate with the same guys overseas. So they find some other country where there's Indians and Pakistanis, and they do their software together there. But that's not quite the same as having a really integrated program. As I said, the World Bank regards South Asia as the world's least integrated region economically. And the Indians, everybody's afraid of being swamped by Indian goods, Indian economic power. But the Indians, you know, that's a legitimate concern. It's like America and Latin America and so forth. But the Indians, the Pakistanis, you know, want to hold off until there's a settlement of Kashmir, for example. And also their companies are protectionist. They're worried about competing with the Indian firms. So that's why I say until there's a strategic agreement reached at the top, you're not going to get much economic movement between the two. And I think that's necessary for Pakistan for its economy to grow. But the Pakistanis, the first time I went to Pakistan in 1977, I went by myself and I spent a day with the Ford Foundation there. And they were just closing their office. They're shutting out, getting out of Pakistan. The reason they were getting out of Pakistan was that they had pitched to the Pakistanis the idea of creating an Indus Valley food machine, that the Indus River would become a giant agriculture production facility, which would export to Europe, and the breadbasket or the fruit basket and vegetable basket of Europe would be Pakistan. They had the labor, they had the water, distances weren't that great, and you have these Boeing wide-body jets to carry the stuff back and forth. And the Pakistanis weren't interested at all, not at all. They couldn't care less. They were very happy because they were doing well in their narrow terms. They weren't looking ahead. The rich were rich in Pakistan. They saw no reason for reform And above all, they saw no reason for land reform in Pakistan. I think if I had to point to one fatal factor in Pakistan, was that historically they've never had serious land reform in Pakistan. Bangladesh did have it. East Pakistan did have it. Taiwan had it. Japan had it. Korea had it. Land reform creates a whole new class of entrepreneurs and landowners. Pakistan hasn't done it, so I think that's one of the root causes of Pakistan's malaise. It's not religion so much as failure to do land reform. So unless that happens, you know, I don't see the economy being transformed quickly.
We have time for one more question.
They do make... The missionaries in the 1930s established a surgical instrument manufacturing company, and that's still going strong, but you can't build an economy for 175 million people on surgical instruments.
So you've mentioned the key, in one of the key starting points towards normalization of the region, obviously, is normalization of relations with India. That can be in terms of nuclear weapons, economic integration, and various other things, but at some point, it would also presumably include Kashmir. And what would be satisfactory from a Pakistani standpoint in terms of settlement over Kashmir?
I think that you have to break the Pakistani constituency down into parts. If you looked at Sindhis and people in Karachi, there's a community of Pakistanis in Karachi who came from India. They don't care much about Kashmir at all. For them, it's not an issue. But if you look at Punjabis or Kashmiris in Punjab and around Islamabad, they care passionately about Kashmir. It's a vibrant, radical cause for them. So there's difference between north and south in Pakistan, east and west in Pakistan regarding Kashmir. So that's a new development in the last 5 years, when some of the ethnic minority groups in Pakistan realize that they're being dragged down by the Kashmir dispute. They'd like to get rid of it. But the army doesn't hold that view. The army says that we fought for Kashmir for 60 years. Why should we give it up now? Now that we have nuclear weapons, there's even less reason to give it up. And some in the army will say that, okay, we may not get Kashmir, but we're bleeding the Indians up in Kashmir. We're forcing the Indians to put down these insurrections in Kashmir. So from their point of view, you know, if you can't win it, at least you can force the other side to lose. It's like I guess in the northwest part of the United States, this tribal, was it the Kwakiutls or one of these? I read it as an undergraduate, so correct me if I'm wrong. The tribe would have a competition each year, and the winner of the tribe was the faction that destroyed most of their own property. So it's not a zero-sum game, but a zero-zero, whatever. So from the Pakistani point of view and from the Indian point of view, they don't mind if they're hurt as long as the other side is hurting worse. So with that kind of psychology, which is sort of at the root of it, you're not going to go forward very quickly at all. You have to go to the Middle East, perhaps the Balkans, to see the same kind of psychology operating. What they need is a common threat, perhaps. And I've always argued that environmental degradation is a common threat or a purpose for which they could work together. There are areas of cooperation and areas where there's huge interest between India and Pakistan. Culturally, they're very similar countries. So deep down, the language, the food, the cricket are all shared. And Pakistani film stars are hugely popular in India. And Indian videos and Indian films are hugely popular in Pakistan. But you can't make a peace on the basis of that. That will facilitate a peace once the leadership decides to normalize. On the Indian side, Manmohan Singh clearly and some other senior government officials believe that normalization with Pakistan is very important, should be a high priority. But most Indian politicians don't care about it. They're content to let Pakistan sort of wither away. On the Pakistani side, I think there's increasing understanding, even in the army, that a butting their head against the Indian wall is not going to get them very, not going to improve them very much, not going to lead to a bright future. So I think there's alarm in the army about the nature of Pakistan's future. This is a very pessimistic presentation, but I think it's shared by most Pakistanis now. 5-10 years ago, I was regarded as a naysayer, you know, this guy's anti-Pakistani for saying these things. But now this is sort of accepted wisdom in Pakistan, and even in the army. But then the army will tell you, well, how do we get out of this without conceding to the Indians, you know, our sworn enemies? as I said, Pakistanis are paranoids, but they have real enemies. So I think, you know, I think there should be an American role in this. It should be the kind of tiptoeing behind the back door, not open and public, but quiet public, quiet private diplomacy, where we try to facilitate normalization process. I would like to see the Chinese involved in this. I think China is a big part of this. But that may be too much for this administration to take on.
First, turn this back on. I'd like to thank Dr. Cohen for coming to Alaska and visiting, like he said, the Juneau World Affairs Council. And today, this morning, he was at West High School and then here for us. And we have a book of Alaska, and hopefully you will come back soon. Thank you very much.
Please invite me.
I think that was a yes. Our next program will be on Friday, our next Friday, with Chancellor Fran Ulmer, and she will be speaking to us on Deepwater Horizon oil spill, lessons learned, and implications for Alaska and the Arctic, taking back some experiences from her recent trip to Norway. This will be here at the Hilton. The doors will open at 11:30, and the program will start at noon. Please send in an RSVP. Thank you.